As I mentioned before about the Sermon on the Mount, you know, he started with the Beatitudes and how it was a description of those who would be in the kingdom. Those who would be in the kingdom. So Jesus is preparing his listeners for the day of Pentecost. No doubt some of the people that he's preaching to in the Sermon on the Mount were there in Jerusalem, hearing that gospel and answering that gospel call. So we have, and like I said, we talked about the Beatitudes. And last week, we got down in Matthew chapter 5. We talked and finished about, we talked about the influence with salt and light. But I want to go back now to verse 17 of that chapter, because that's kind of where the handout starts. And we're going to look at verses 17 through 20. Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For surely I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. So whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Of course, the law and the prophets were a little, the Jewish people arranged their Bible a little differently. The same books, of course, but they arranged them a little differently. We know about the law and we know about the prophets as far as the Old Testament books and what they would have talked about. Jesus said, and we'll probably have a chance to read it, that the law and the prophets told about him. So all the way back to the book of Genesis, the Old Testament talked about Christ. I mean, Genesis and Exodus, Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and Joshua and Judges, all the way through the Old Testament, talked about Christ. Talked about the Messiah. Talked about the coming King. Talked about the new covenant he would bring. And on and on and on. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of prophecies. So, Jesus said, don't be mistaken. You know, don't be led to believe that I have come to destroy the law of the prophets. He said, I did not come to destroy them in any sense. You know, he had already been accused of that. You know, the Pharisees had accused him of breaking the law. You know, they said he had broke the law. And they would do that. They would accuse him of that. Remember, they accused him of breaking the Sabbath laws. Well, he broke their traditions, didn't break the law. So Jesus said, don't think that I came to destroy it. He says, I did not. I have no intention of destroying it. I have no intention of breaking it in any way. So the second question on our handout is, what was the relationship of Jesus to the law? Well, let's read those two passages. Let's go to Romans chapter 10, verse 4. And whoever gets there, just go ahead and read it for us, if you don't mind. And then we'll go to Colossians 2. But Romans 10, verse 4.
For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness.
Okay. Christ is the end of the law. Christ is the goal of the law. Is another way that's sometimes translated. The law was to lead people to Christ. It was to lead people to Christ. We know we talked about the law being a tutor. The law taught people about Christ, led people to Christ, so that when he actually came, people would be ready. People should have been ready for the Messiah. I mean, it had been predicted for centuries that he was going to come, that he would be born in Bethlehem, how he would be born to a virgin, and all these things. So people should have been prepared for his coming. So he was the end of the law, the fulfillment of the law, the completion of the law, the goal of the law. So that was his relationship. So now let's go to Colossians 2. I don't know if you're writing these things down as we go, but that's up to you. Colossians 2, and we'll read verses 13 and 14. Colossians 2, verses 13 and 14. Would someone read those two verses for us?
And you, being dead in your sins, and the uncircumcision of your flesh, has he quickened together with him, having forgiven you all trespasses, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to the cross.
What did Jesus do? He took it out of the way. Now, he didn't destroy it, but he was the final part of it, if you will. He was the final act, was Jesus coming and dying on the cross. And then, of course, being resurrected. That was the end of it. Everything from Genesis on had been leading up to Christ being crucified on Calvary. And that's why it talks about he nailed it. He took it out of the way. He nailed it to the cross. It was finished. It was fulfilled. It was done. It had served its purpose. So when it talks about until everything was fulfilled, all of these prophecies had to be fulfilled. And that's what Jesus did. He fulfilled all of those prophecies about the Messiah, about the King, all of those things and what he would do on the cross. You know, all of those things were predicted, even about how he would enter Jerusalem and how he would be crucified. All of those things were predicted. So Jesus was the fulfillment. That's why he says, I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Well, then he says, assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. One jot or one tittle was the smallest markings in the Hebrew language. So Jesus is saying, even down to the tiniest parts of the law, everything is going to be fulfilled. Every tiny last thing, nothing, all right? Nothing is going to go unfulfilled. So he said, you can mark my words about that. Every little part of it would be fulfilled. And those would be the jot or the tittle would be the least of the commandments, but they were going to be fulfilled in every sense of the term, down to the most minute details. And some people would think some of those prophecies were pretty insignificant, but they weren't. They just went to show how accurate those prophets were. They were inspired. And so they predicted and prophesied about things hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years in the future. I mean, Isaiah alone prophesied, you know, over 700 years before the birth of Christ. And he prophesied both about his birth, Isaiah 7, and his death, Isaiah 53. So Isaiah prophesied about both ends, beginning and end, of Jesus' life. So all of those things Jesus fulfilled, even down to the tiniest detail. This is what separates the Bible from every other book. You cannot find any other so-called religious holy book that is accurate like the Bible. They all have many, many, many errors in them. I mean, you can go to the Quran. The Quran has some of the most ridiculous errors in it you could imagine. The Book of Mormon has some ridiculous errors in it that are just completely wrong and false. And you can go to all of those, and they all have errors in them, not the Bible. You know, atheists and agnostics have been trying to find one for centuries. Never found a one. Never found a one. And so the Bible is at a whole different level than all other religious books of every religion. Whole new level. And one of those things is the fulfillment of prophecies, especially about Jesus. Well, then he says, whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments. Okay, and he's talking, just think about the jot or the tittle. You know, just a little mark on one of the Hebrew letters. All right? And teaches men so. So not only do they break one of the commandments, but they teach people to break them. Those people don't have any hope. Of course, not just from this verse, but a lot of other verses as well. So those people don't have any hope whatsoever. Of course, this is all about Bible authority. And you know, we are in a time when people, so many people, don't have any respect for the Bible whatsoever. I mean, even when I was growing up, even people that didn't go to church had respect for the Bible. But that is not the case now. I mean, all you have to do is teach public high school and you'll hear all kinds of things along that line where people, even teenagers, many of them have absolutely no respect for the Bible. And of course, we're in a rural school in the Bible Belt. So I can't imagine what it would be like in other parts of the country. So the Bible has lost respect with a great segment of our population. Very different than just a few decades ago. So Jesus said, people that teach men to break it, I mean, they're essentially cursed for what they're doing. So again, it's about, you know, Bible authority. And two of the worst offenders in the first century were the Jews and Pharisees. The worst condemnation that came out of Jesus' mouth that we have recorded were to the scribes and Pharisees. I mean, the worst. He's going to mention them here. The worst condemnation were to those groups of people. The things Jesus condemns them for is for teaching people their own traditions and interpretations instead of what the Bible actually said. And he talked about teaching the doctrines and commandments of men, another place in Matthew. And he says, and in vain they worship him. Because of what they were doing and teaching, their worship wasn't accepted at all, not even a little bit. So he says, for I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. I like this question on the handout. Imagine the effect on Jesus' as he told them they had to be more righteous than the Pharisees. Why would many have considered this challenge impossible? Why would people have thought that was an impossible challenge?
Because the Pharisees set themselves up as being the most righteous
group. That's right. They wanted all the greetings in the marketplace, Rabbi, Rabbi, and they wanted the best seats in the synagogue, and they thought they were it spiritually. I mean, they thought they were the religious elite. So when Jesus is talking about having to exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees, I'm sure many of the people said, well, that's not possible, because they're the most religious people around. Well, Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven, Your righteousness has to exceed that of their righteousness was very, as he points out here, flawed. Was very, very flawed. And is about Jesus correcting how twisted the old things that they didn't say. And so he's part of that is he's correcting, especially in those parts that where you have heard it said. Not it is written, but those parts where he says, you've heard it said. And a lot of that's directed to the scribes and Pharisees because they said things, they twisted the scriptures to make it say what they wanted it to say. And that was to make them look good. And that's what exactly they were doing, trying to make themselves look good. So, let's go to Matthew 23. That's one of the main places he talks about the Pharisees. Right. And then they just multiplied it, you know, 100-fold. Exactly. Oh, yeah. The cross didn't stop them. So let's look at Matthew 23:23. If someone doesn't mind reading, I know that's quite a few verses, but 23 through 28 is where Jesus really gets down on the Pharisees and why he gets down on them. Matthew 23:23 through 28, if someone wouldn't mind reading those six verses.
Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides, straining out a great a gnat and swallowing a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate, that the outside also may be clean. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees and hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and uncleanliness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others, but within you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness.
And of course, verse 28 is where he sums up what he's been talking about. You know, he's been using these examples of cups and dishes and tombs and so forth. He said, outwardly, you do appear to be righteous, religious. But he said, look at what's inside. He said, you are so rotten and corrupt on the inside that you would stink like a tomb. He says, that's how bad you are. He called them blind. He called them hypocrites. See, they were concerned. Well, just think about, they tithe these little herbs, all right, like cumin and dill and so forth, they would tithe that. See, and people would think, wow, they're even tithing these little mints that and stuff they grew in their garden. Wow, they're very religious. But Jesus said, you do that, but he says you neglect the things that are harder, like justice and mercy and faith. Those were too hard for the Pharisees to do, so they weren't going to do it. Way too hard. But it was easy to tithe, so they did that. And it would make them look good outwardly. He says, neglecting justice and mercy and faith, those are hard to see. So they weren't concerned about doing those. They were just concerned about doing what people could see. And he was condemning them for it. And that's why he said, you were like the cup and dish. He says, outwardly, you cleaned it. But why would you clean just the outside? That's the dirtiest. The dirtiest part's on the inside. And he says, you haven't touched it. Same way with the tomb. Just because you paint the outside of a tomb, that doesn't clean anything. You've left the inside still filled with corruption and rottenness and decay. He says, that's exactly what you're like. You're so rotten on the inside. And I think some people have the mistaken idea that the old law never talked about those things. Talked about them a lot. And I think he mentions that in part F. We've noted that the Sermon on the Mount stresses the heart and the inward character that a member of the kingdom must possess. But before considering what Jesus has to say about murder and other subjects in the rest of the chapter, it says, read the following and decide whether the old law was a law of the heart or only a ceremonial law. Okay, let's read some of these. Deuteronomy 6, verse 5. And if you get there, go ahead and read it. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 5.
You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind.
Okay. Now that's interesting. Because a lot of that's on the inside, isn't it? A lot of that's on the inside. Love him with all your heart and soul. Well, that's inward. That's inward. It wasn't just loving God through their external actions. It was loving God from the inside. Well, let's go back to Leviticus 19 then and see what those verses tell us. Leviticus 19, 17. Leviticus 19, 17 and 18. If somebody has that, go ahead. All right. Where does hate lie? In your heart. So even in the Old Testament, God's people were told not to hate your brother. You know, he's going to say that here real soon in the Sermon on the Mount. Don't hate your brother. Don't take vengeance. Now notice he says, love your neighbor as yourself. Do you just love yourself outwardly? Of course not. You love yourself inwardly too. And then let's read one more. Exodus chapter 20, verse 17. Exodus 20, verse 17. So whoever has that, just go ahead. You shall not covet. That happens on the inside, doesn't it? You see something your neighbor has, you know, possessions or whatever, and what do? You covet. You want it. See, you become envious. Where's that? That's on the inside. And of course, Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments. in the Old Testament, and we could look at many, many others, conditions of the heart were important. They were important. Yeah, there were a lot of external things they were to do. You know, all you have to do is read the book of Leviticus and see that over and over again. But there was also an aspect of it that stressed the heart. All right, back to Matthew 5. He said in verse 21, "You have heard that it was said to those of old." All right? "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment.'" All right? And of course, they were told not to murder, right? That's one of the Ten Commandments. It's one of the Ten Commandments. But he says, "And whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment." And they certainly were, weren't they? If you intentionally killed someone, and I don't mean by accident or unintentionally, I mean intentionally killed, and that's what murder means, it was a death penalty. Capital punishment. But he says, "But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment." Well, now we just read that in the Old Testament, you had to be careful about what went on the inside. It wasn't just external, okay? But what had a lot of the Jewish rabbis and scribes and Pharisees done through the years? They had taken it where things on the inside didn't matter. You could hate somebody with the worst hatred imaginable, and that was fine. You just couldn't kill them. Well, Jesus is saying they took that out of the way God meant it. God never meant for His people to have hatred of other people. He never wanted them to hate people. Never has. So a lot of these things had been twisted and misapplied by the Pharisees and scribes and others through the years. And Jesus is saying, that's not what God wants. He says, "Whoever says to his brother, 'Raca,' shall be in danger of the council. Whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hell fire." And of course, that's a progression. Look at the condemnation. It kind of says, "Whoever murders, whoever's angry with his brother, shall be in danger of the judgment. Shall be in danger of the council." That seems to be the Sanhedrin. "Whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hell fire." That's final condemnation. So there's a progression here, and the word "fool" here, that's not telling somebody they're acting foolish. There's nothing wrong with that, nor has there ever been. But the word here has this idea of contempt and hatred and spite. I mean, something really intense. We don't think of the word "fool" like that today. So we don't want to take this out of the way in which Jesus said it. Okay, we need to look at what it meant in the first century, not how we use the word "fool" today. So there were people who were hating and being spiteful and showing contempt. And he says those people are in danger of hellfire. Those people are in danger of hellfire for how they are acting. And of course, as he mentions here in our handout, what beatitudes are missing for a person who commits the sins of verse 22? Well, acting like that, you're not showing mercy, you're not showing compassion. the things he's already talked about in the Beatitudes, you're not displaying. I mean, if you're showing hatred and contempt and that level of spite, then you're certainly not displaying the Beatitudes in any sense. Do we sometimes apply the commandment regarding you fool in a Pharisaic fashion? Yeah, I think we do, and that's what I was just talking about. What beatitude or beatitudes would motivate a person to be reconciled with his brother before bringing a gift to the altar? Now notice, that's the very next thing. I should read verse 23 first. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. And of course, obviously that's assuming your brother wants to be reconciled. I mean, that you can't make somebody reconcile with you. That's impossible. Just like I can't make you do anything. I can't make you read your Bible. I can't make you pray. I can't make you give. I can't make you do any of those things. So sometimes,
what are you going to say about the gift? What is the gift?
Well, you're making this is an act of worship. Bringing your gift to the altar is an act of worship. So before you worship, it's more important, necessary, that you try to reconcile. And notice I say try. Because it's not always possible. Just like later on in the Bible it says, as much as lies within you, be at peace with all men. Because you cannot make other people do anything. You simply can't do it. You can't make them do this. You can't make them do that. You can't make them be the kind of person you want them to be. You cannot do it. You can't make your kids grow up to be a certain way. You can influence them to do it. You can't make them. So, do what you can, all right? The other person may not want anything to do with it, all right? And if they don't, that's their responsibility. You do what you can. And then let it go. Let it lie, I guess is the word. So, do what you can, as he says. So, again, the Beatitudes form the basis for all of these things. And he says, going on, agree with your adversary quickly. So now he's talking, you know, more about an enemy, an adversary. Agree with your adversary quickly while you're on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. Till you have paid the very last penny. So, not only is it good moral advice, it's good religious advice. It's good practical advice. So he says, be careful. You know, do your part, I guess is the best thing. Do your part. And sometimes doing your part means practicing tough love. You know, sometimes your part is practicing tough love. Someone is doing wrong, okay? You can't, to be reconciled with them, you can't tell them that everything is fine. Can't do that. You must be honest. All right? If they're living in sin in some way, or if they've committed a sin in some way, you can't say, well, that's okay, let's just be at peace. Can't do it. We can never fellowship sin in any way. Under any circumstances. And he's not telling us to fellowship sin here. He doesn't want us to fellowship sin in any sense of that term. But he does give us advice, all right? He does give us advice. When you can, agree with your adversary quickly, all right? Your enemy, if you want to call him that. So don't, if we have done something wrong, okay? If we've done something wrong, then he says, take care of it quickly. That's, I think, is really his point here. If you've done something wrong, if you've sinned against someone, then go take care of it quickly. Don't wait 10 years. He says, do it now. He says, otherwise it might have some very bad consequences. All right? And again, if you haven't done anything wrong, certainly he doesn't tell you to, you know, lie and say you did something wrong. Obviously, he doesn't want you to do that. But if you have done something wrong, then take care of it quickly. Sooner the better. The sooner the better.
Wrongly accused, the way I see that, if you're...
And wrongly accused, that would be good too.
Everything in your power to work out the user, whatever is standing
right
in the way.
Whatever the problem is, yeah.
If you're accused of something and you're not, you know in your own mind that you're not guilty.
Yeah.
You still have to make every effort with him or you're going to wind up in court.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Unjustifiably.
Do what you can. Do what you can. I think that's what he wants. And quickly. All right? And quickly. Again, you're not to be dishonest. You're not to say something that's not true. You're not supposed to deceive people. You're not to sin. Just to have peace, you know, the other places in the Bible tell us not to do that. So, there are obviously extenuating circumstances where you have to make judgment calls.